You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
In July 2017, China rocked the recycling world.
When it comes to importing garbage, no country bought in more of it than China.
China has banned the import of millions of tons of plastic waste.
And the world have to handle their waste, a decision most weren't ready for.
For the last two decades, it's been dependent on China.
Hong Kong is the world's gateway to China.
China's national sword policy. The strict restrictions imposed on what kinds of paper and plastic can be shipped to mainland China for processing back into the manufacturing cycle. It caused panicked headlines in Western media, but there was no denying it exposed the global recycling industry as essentially a trafficking operation, shipping waste from Western countries into China and other nations in Southeast Asia. For veterans of recycling and sustainability, it was about time.
I think it's fantastic that China has closed the boundaries. I mean, it really forces everybody to change the practices. Shipping of waste is something to be banned. Waste is such an unqualified material, highly polluting, and it tends to find its way to low-cost markets where you have very poor facilities to deal with it. So I'm very happy to see that China has banned it and closed the boundaries for it. I wish Hong Kong would do the same.
This is Paul Zimmerman. You're going to be hearing more from him in a minute or two.
Most people in America, the UK, Western Europe thought, oh, I'm recycling in my green bin, my blue bin, my whatever bin, and magic.
Here's Richard Brubaker from Shanghai. You met him in our second episode.
Well, actually, magic meant traders would sell those materials to Asian countries, by and large China. And Chinese entrepreneurs or Chinese businesses would buy that stuff, they'd process it, and they put it back into the economy of China. But most people really just didn't understand how the waste flow worked. They thought it was recycling was something that just magically happened in their home country, and it was fully circular in their home country. And I think that was the first myth that just exploded right there.
With the exploded myth of recycling comes one specific harsh reality for the world. What are we going to do with all this plastic? As one professor puts it,
plastic you say therefore.
Welcome to China's Recycling Revolution. I'm Laurie Chen.
There are now more microplastics in the ocean than stars in the galaxy.
Plastic in cigarettes.
That's a plastic fork.
If you go back in time, a world without plastic was very much a reality.
The idea that somehow it can be 50% plastic, 50%
cheap,
fish.
Sterile and convenient. It changed our lives.
PepsiCola's new 2-liter plastic bottle is 25% lighter than glass.
The less we consume.
Now, usually in a news feature about the overuse of plastic in the world, you can expect the producers to supply a low-frequency electronic soundtrack full of foreboding and doom. And then run a montage of images of huge drifts of plastic in the ocean, high tides of plastic bottles covering beaches, and of course, turtles, fish, and whales all choking on bits of plastic. But this is a podcast. And besides, you've seen those images. We know there is no denying how serious the ocean plastic crisis is. Now I'm going to take you to meet some people who are putting ideas into practice about our plastic problem, and provoke a bit of thought about what needs to happen now that the myth of recycling has been exploded. First, let me step you back briefly to July 2017. North Korea test launches its first intercontinental ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan, causing experts to theorize Alaska was now in range of Kim Jong-un. The United States Court of Appeals hears a case on whether a macaque monkey owns the copyright to its own selfie. And Jenna Jambek, an assistant professor at the College of Engineering at the University of Georgia, publishes a paper with her team titled simply,
Production, Use, and Fate of All Plastics Ever Made.
In 2015, she had published the first paper to calculate how much plastic was going into our oceans. Jambek and her team calculated there were 5 grocery-sized bags filled with plastic for every foot of coastline in the world. In 2017, their research connected the amount of plastic in our oceans with what was being produced on land. It connected worldwide data on solid waste with population density and economic status. This is the study quoted by every reputable news piece about marine plastic pollution, and here is the most quoted part of that study.
Only 9% of plastic waste has been recycled globally, with the overwhelming majority of global plastic waste being landfilled or ending up contaminating the environment, resulting in an estimated 4 million to 12 million metric tons of waste plastic entering the oceans annually.
The world's media ran with the forecast for how much that would be in the year 2050, 8.3 billion metric tons, and got their infographic artists to show to you that's the equivalent of 25,000 Empire State Buildings, or 1 billion elephants, or 18 times the weight of the entire human population. But let me ask you something. When was the last time you stood in front of the Empire State Building? When was the last time you stood next to an elephant? Now think about this. When was the last time you held a plastic bottle of water in your hand? Because here in Hong Kong, we throw away 5.2 million plastic bottles every day. That's much less than the 60 million plastic bottles thrown out every day in the US, but it's still 136 tons of plastic, and Hong Kong has a lot less real estate to dump it in. Remember Jackson Lau? His company ships 5 shipping containers with 4 tons worth of empty plastic bottles from Hong Kong every month to Germany. That leaves 4,000 tons of unrecycled plastic bottles in Hong Kong every month. And right now, there's only one place they can go in Hong Kong, straight to landfill. Paul Zimmerman is an elected district councillor in Hong Kong, and he also convenes a group called Drinks Without Waste, a group of stakeholders that includes drink producers, bottlers, retailers and recyclers.
So we now have all the main drink producers, Swire, so Vitasoy and A.S. Watson's are the big ones in Hong Kong, that and it covers 60% of the drink market, 40% is importers, we got some of them. Then the waste and recycling industry and some of the retailers and some of the institutions like airport, MTR.
Paul just mentioned Swire. That's the company which owns the franchise for Coca-Cola in Hong Kong, mainland China and Taiwan. It boasts on its website that it sells 1.7 billion units every year. In 2018, this group of 25 stakeholders, bringing together the biggest suppliers and retailers of drinks sold in disposable plastic bottles, published a 4-point strategy. The first strategy was to reduce single-use beverage containers.
The second strategy is to redesign the packaging materials for beverages to limit to materials which can be recycled. So that's going to require a ban, and the industry will have to come up with which materials. And so you need the recyclers and the beverage industry to agree which materials. And then we need to ban the ones that cannot be recycled.
So far, there's been no agreement.
The third strategy is recovery. How do you get the packaging back from the consumer after consumption? And the best way to do that, we figured out, is to put money on it. And now whether that's a deposit, i.e. pay money at the shop and you get it back when you return a bottle, or whether it's a top-up value for the people that collect recyclable materials to make sure that there is a reasonable value, promoting, basically enabling the whole market that we currently see that recycle, say, aluminum cans, which 85% are recovered, that the same industry, the same sector of cleaners and recyclers and scavengers and so on, that they will pick up the materials and make sure to get the money for it.
That strategy came out a year ago, or if you like, 1.9 billion drink containers ago. And their fourth strategy?
And the fourth strategy is to make sure we build recycling facilities in Hong Kong that can handle the packaging materials. So there is now a PET factory being built, is now being commissioned by Swire Waste Management in joint venture with Alba and Baguio.
A facility just like the one Henry Wang in Melbourne built in the 18 months after the National Sword Policy came in. It's due to open in 2020. When we rang and checked on its progress, we were told construction hadn't started yet. But there's one major company in Hong Kong who did take action to recycle the packaging they make, with a little bit of help from some community activism. In 2016, a local environmental group called Green Power revealed that 74% of the cartons in landfill in Hong Kong came from one company, the beloved Hong Kong brand Vitasoy. Green Power volunteers took matters into their own hands and set up 17 recycling stations around the city to collect cartons and send them to a specialist recycling facility in Thailand. Some 3 years later, Vitasoy have just made an announcement. This month, they're opening a recycling facility which will separate the plastic and cardboard from the millions of cartons of soy milk sold locally in Hong Kong. It's a facility very much like the one we told you about in episode 1, built in South Carolina by a company based in Xiamen, China. There's no mention yet of any similar facility being built by Vitasoy subsidiaries in mainland China, Australia, Singapore, North America, or the Philippines. But at least it's a start as the landfill crisis looms in Hong Kong. And there are others in Hong Kong with ideas that go beyond recycling to eliminate packaging altogether.
My name is Ada Yip. My company is called Urban Spring. What we do is to reduce single-use plastic bottles by providing well-designed and well-maintained water refill stations across our city.
Ask yourself, when was the last time you used a public water fountain? This is the issue that Ada and the Urban Spring Company confronted. It's a matter of trust. And the other issue was combating a few billion dollars worth of marketing, starting 40 years ago when a French brand of sparkling spring water hired Orson Welles to do some commercials.
Deep below the plains of southern France, in a mysterious process begun millions of years ago, nature herself adds life to the icy waters of a single spring.
And I think, you know, the companies do a very good job in marketing and advertising, getting everyone to believe that tap water is not clean enough. Bottled water, it's cleaner, healthier, which I think it's not true in every city, not in every city. For example, in Hong Kong, water quality is excellent. I think with all that and convenience, right, whether it's the takeaway culture, the advertising on TV in particular, to show people that whether it's your bottled of soft drinks or water, it's convenient, it's light, it's cheap. Just give people that impression that's the way to go, right? And that's why people switch. And once you switch and believe that it is better and cheaper and it's convenient, it's difficult to go back.
As for trust, Ada turned to technology to win back the public's trust, starting with researching exactly why people didn't trust public water fountains.
We looked at the pain points, basically, why are people not using fountains today, right? They're worried about it, they don't trust the water. So we designed it in a way it looks professional, it addressed the hygiene issue, and more importantly, most usually people worried about it's whether there's a filter, when was it changed? So we use data, we use technology to basically grab those information, you know, how much water is being served, when it needs to be changed. So with that, with the transparency, putting on an LCD screen showing people when the water was tested, when the filter was changed, to reestablish that trust of filtered tap water in the public space.
The Urban Spring Company came up with its own design for a water dispenser with an LCD screen that displays the data on the water quality, how new the filter is, and something else.
So people would see, first when they go up, they see number of bottles saved already with that machine. They place their bottle, push the button, so, and then it would tell them some message about you're part of saving the world. And then when they finish the dispense, it would say thank you, and then adding that one person's contribution to that total number.
Every time you fill your reusable bottle, you get told how you've added to the total number of bottles saved. And these units can be networked.
So in, for example, if you know a university actually put multiples, we can actually put the multiple of the 10 or 20 stations. And students can instantly see they are one of the millions to save bottles.
If we're talking behavioral change, Here's Ada's vision for Hong Kong and bottled water in 5 years.
I really hope that in 5 years' time, when you go to an event or when you meet friends, you carry a single-use plastic bottles, you get a dirty eye, a dirty look, right? I think that means that people think it's actually an exception to be having a single use as opposed to today, which is the other way around, right?
Imagine right now what kinds of looks you'd get if you lit up a cigarette in a crowded bar or cafe or restaurant in New York, London or Sydney. It wasn't too long ago that that was perfectly acceptable. That's the kind of behavioural change Ada's thinking about. But while Ada Yip is wrestling with this huge corporate machine and its decades of behaviour-shaping marketing, there's something else from the 20th century which has inserted itself into the modern culture of both the US and China, and it's creating a new wave of disposable plastic trash. Here's historian Susan Strasser again, with the story of how it started in the late 1940s.
So there's this whole post-war explosion of consumer culture, and it ranges from these major appliances to the stuff you're going to use with the major appliances, like, for example, the TV dinner. TV dinners were at first novelties.
The TV dinner, a small pre-prepared meal in a foil or foam container that you heat up at home. But there was a bigger economic and industrial change behind them.
The TV dinner was part of an introduction of not only ease in food preparation, but also expanding the possibilities for food that frozen food represented. And I think it's important to really recognize that the introduction of frozen food meant two things. It meant that people had to have freezers in their houses, and the freezers of the refrigerators before World War II were not very big. So people had to have, if they were going to store frozen food, they had to have bigger freezers. But there's also the necessity to develop what I believe is called in the trade the cold chain, which is to say the entire system whereby frozen foods can be transported from a factory to the store, and where they can be stored at the store. So it's not only the freezers at home, but the freezers at the store and the trucks that can do frozen food.
But now we have new appliances, ones we hold in our hands. And there's a new supply chain, one that leads from your phone to a restaurant, connecting with someone with transport in what we call the gig economy. To bring the food to your door, let's step back to 2015 and the report published by Assistant Professor Jenna Jambic and her team from the University of Georgia. The report they delivered about plastic in our oceans was calculated on a framework of
the amount of mismanaged plastic waste generated annually by populations living within 50 kilometers of a coast worldwide that can potentially enter the oceans as marine debris. For each of 192 coastal countries with at least 100 permanent residents that border the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans, and the Mediterranean and Black Seas. The framework includes the mass of waste generated per capita annually, the percentage of waste that is plastic, and the percentage of plastic waste that is mismanaged and therefore has the potential to enter the ocean as marine debris.
For the year 2010, the US was calculated as having up to 1 million metric tons of mismanaged waste within 50 kilometers of its coastline. Mainland China, it had approximately 5 million metric tons. Now, this was a report published in 2015. Something else happened in 2015.
Uber Eats for Guy. Mr. Fieri, Uber Eats.
It was 1 year after Uber Eats had launched in Los Angeles. And it was the year online food delivery apps exploded across the major cities of China. In 2015, there were just over 200 million people in China's coastal cities ordering food online. A report from Daxue Consulting estimated that last year it was 355 million. There are now more people ordering their meals from food delivery apps in China than there are actual people in the US. And that's a problem, because studies show each of these meals comes with an average 4 pieces of disposable plastic. Single-use plastic and polystyrene waste in the major coastal cities of mainland China increased from 200,000 metric tons in 2015 to 1.5 million metric tons in 2017. This is Professor Jonathan Wong.
Plastic, you say, therefore, it's really difficult to get rid of because it's so easy to use, but also create a lot of trouble.
He's the head of the biology department at Hong Kong University.
I've been doing research on waste management for almost more than 25 years. So my part is mainly on the organic food waste management. So we try to utilize the organic waste into compost, and also we convert using anaerobic digestion for converting food waste into energy. I would say this is the most natural way we can do.
He's gone one step ahead in confronting the plastic problem. If we're seeing a massive increase in plastic bags and containers contaminated with wet food waste, why worry about separating the contaminated plastic?
The only way we can stop the effect of plastic is that the government stop using plastic, change it into other containers. For example, we can use glasses instead of use plastic. In this situation, plastic will not affect our environment. And then, or in the same time, we can change to use biodegradable plastic. So those biodegradable plastic mainly is mainly for plastic bag, replacing the plastic bag. We use biodegradable plastic bag, and then that can go for composting, that can go for incineration, or go through either to the landfill site. They can degradable. Then there will be no more plastic in our environment.
Remember when we were with Claire Zhang in Shanghai and she showed us how the new 4-bin system worked? She was fine with everything except one detail, separating the dry waste from wet waste.
What makes me a little bit, and not totally comfortable is the wet part, because especially in summer, we'll throw them away, open it, and then put the bags back to the dry one.
That's exactly where Professor Wong's research has led him.
When we're doing waste collection for organic food waste, so you need some container or use some kind of biodegradable plastic bag to go together with it, so that you, when you go to the composting pile, you can fold the whole bag together with the waste into the composting pile, and then you can do composting.
He wants Mrs. Zhang to be able to throw the whole bag into the compost pile with the other wet food waste.
For biodegradable plastic bag, they got a market. They should go together with food waste and then go to either anaerobic digestion or a composting pile, so that finally they become part of the composting material or become the anaerobic digesting material.
There's a market, all right. More than 25 million people in Shanghai who don't want to reach into a bin and shake the wet food waste out of plastic bags. We found someone who's not exactly a small entrepreneur trying to break into this exact market in mainland China.
Rowan Williams is my name. I look after market development for Asia Pacific for biopolymers EcoFlex and EcoVO.
Rowan works for BASF, one of the world's biggest multinational chemical companies. Quick bit of trivia for you. During the 1930s, BASF invented a product called styrofoam. Here in the 21st century, the company is at the forefront of research and development of different plastics, including bioplastic, and their largest R&D facility in Asia is in Shanghai.
We don't market these as biodegradable materials because that label is meaningless to consumers.
But he's just going to clear up any use of the word biodegradable first.
Having something labelled biodegradable doesn't tell you the when, the where, the why, the how, if any biodegradation actually occurs, and if it does, what are the byproducts of that biodegradation? Having certified compostable products gives a guarantee that when these products ultimately biodegrade in the end of life that they're destined for, all they leave behind is small amounts of CO2, some water, and biomass, or what's described as humus or compost type organic material. There's no fragments of plastics. There's no toxic residues. There's nothing left behind from these materials at all. That's the benefit of being certified to global standards.
And it's an important point, because it leads us from the huge problem of plastic waste to another global problem, but one that is very relevant to China.
We're targeting very specific areas, such as the organic waste recycling, biodegradable mulch film and compostable packaging are the three key segments that we see future growth in. The whole reason that you have compostable plastics to replace the inappropriately disposed ones is actually dealing with an issue of food security, which people don't make the link. And by food security, I mean the ability of a country to feed its people, you know, independently of, you know, other countries. And what's important here is to remember that we're positioning these products to collect food waste or food soiled materials such that we get that organic waste back into the soil as part of a circular economy. What's driven some of these things in China is recognition of the parlous state of soil in China. And the fastest and quickest way of getting soil organic carbon levels back up to productive levels is to get more organic matter back into the soil and reduce your dependence on fertilizers. It's a long way from talking about compostable plastics, isn't it, when we start talking about food security.
But what about the food containers? What about the food delivery apps that are driving the tsunami of single-use plastics across the coastal megacities of China? Let me bring you back to Hong Kong. And to a person who can best be described as a hippie with a shrewd business acumen, an ecopreneur. His name is Bobsy Gaya, and in the ruthless, cutthroat world that is Hong Kong's restaurant industry, he's a veteran and a pioneer on many levels.
So in 1997-98, when we opened the Bookworm Cafe on Lama Island, arguably Hong Kong's first lifestyle, vegan, organic cafe, we were zero plastic even back then. So what I'm saying is this sort of zero plastic, plastic-free packaging has been around forever.
So now, he runs a chain of organic vegetarian restaurants in Hong Kong called Manna, serving what he calls fast, slow food.
You have to have a cost to run a business. You have to pay your rent, your salary burden, your utilities, cost of operations, and so on and so forth. Well, of course, you have to factor in your waste disposal. Why would you not? Okay? So having said all of that, yes, there is a cost.
So what's the cost? What's he paying for his Manna restaurants to not use plastic?
I can give you a comparison. Our salad boxes in Manna, which are biodegradable, made from paper and plant plastic, they cost us approximately $2.5 to $3 a box. A styrofoam lunchbox from the Dai Pai Dong or the restaurant next door costs 10 cents. That's a huge difference. Now, of course, between the 10 cents and the $3, there's a whole range of different packagings you can apply, depending what you want.
So, while the Hong Kong government moves into its 15th year of debating whether it should ask its residents to separate their waste, and whether there should be the same kind of waste tax that Taiwan introduced in the year 2000, Bobsy is setting an example that might just be useful to the people of Shanghai.
So what's happening now, and this is a major breakthrough that only happened this year, we can compost all our packaging together with our food waste. So what is food waste? Food waste are all the cuttings, the leftovers, the coffee grinds, the pulp from the juicing. It's not food that's being wasted. It's the amount of waste that's generated by any restaurant. It's called food waste. Now this is a resource that can be turned into compost to make very good soil, which gives you in return very good vegetables. So it's a cycle that needs to be looped and closed. So plant plastic was an issue with us, a big problem, because we knew it wasn't getting properly composted or even recycled. But starting 2019, we collect all of our packaging. That means the coffee cup lids, the coffee cups, the salad boxes, the plates, the cutlery, and deliver it together with the food waste, that's all the leftovers from customers, kitchen cuttings, all collectively together goes into the same anaerobic composting system.
Plant plastic instead of plastic made from fossil fuels. It's more expensive, but it might just be the missing link that joins the loop between the food producers, the food retailers, and the people like you and me, the food consumers.
So if there's a system that really needs a significant amount of attention and investment of time and money, it's going to be the food waste systems of China.
This is Richard Brubaker again. You met him in episode 2, talking about Shanghai.
We're not talking about a little bit of food. We're talking about hundreds of tons a day, thousands of tons a month, right? Or tens of thousands of tons a month. You can't just bury that in a landfill. You can't put that into an incinerator. You need to find new ways.
Richard is studying and documenting the innovation about recycling that's going on in Shanghai. Not the apps, not the facial recognition tech, but how science is being applied to the issue of where to put all this stuff left over from dinner. It's a really basic idea, a low-tech, centuries-old idea that Bobsy is using in Hong Kong. A compost pile filled with worms, converting food waste into nutrient-rich soil.
And so in the city of Shanghai, we found one guy, and there's multiples that are running around, but we found one guy. He's taking about 50 tons of waste a day. He put it onto soil that was hard, that was not really farmable. And he's been taking 50 tons a day and creating this worm compost that is rehabilitating the soil. Now, he's not able to sell that compost to the general ag market yet. He's only allowed to sell it to the landscaping facilities around the city. So he can't make his business work. But what was interesting to see was that the local government officials were monitoring the soil health on a regular basis, as well as all the fruits that were coming off. He had grapes, he had eggplant, tomatoes, you know, a wide range of things that he was growing. And they're testing that to make sure that the food itself is safe. And that's not because they don't know what they're doing.
Why are they doing it?
They're doing it because they're scientists, and they want to make sure that they can show that they've done the work, and they can show the public that this is safe stuff. Because when you're talking to 35 million people, there's a baseline of information that you have to either establish, correct, or support. And so the best way to do that is really through the science of it and to pilot and make sure like nothing's happening. Because that way they can open up the system. They can show you like, look, this is what's happening. Look at all the worms and look at what's coming out and look at how we use it. And oh yeah, it took this old brown site that had no nutrients left in the soil and it rehabilitated the soil, which for me gets really interesting because that feeds back to China's big problem, which is soil. You know, the report that they did on soil 10 years ago became a state secret for about 5 years. Well, if they're able to find ways to, through innovation, through entrepreneurship, at the city level, improve that issue as well, well, now you're creating a real circular economy. It's not take, make, waste anymore. It's like, okay, you've wasted. We found a resource there. That resource will help us solve another problem, and that will actually help us grow better food for the country.
China is responsible for almost a third of the world's plastic production. Its manufacturers are racing to increase the use of corn, sugar, and other crops in new varieties of plastic, but it's a fraction of the global output. Which leads us back to where we started. How much do we care about separating our trash? China is part of the problem. But now it's trying to make its biggest city part of the solution by teaching it how to separate wet from dry, toxic from recyclable. And the Western world is facing up to the reality of the plastic it throws away. Just because we choose to recycle something doesn't mean that's what will happen. There has to be an industry to support it, one that makes a profit. Nations like the US and Australia are struggling to build a new economic and industrial model around recycling after decades of apathy. But the other aspect of this new reality is what we choose to buy in the first place. Unless consumers start choosing products made of recycled plastic, the companies trying to sell it will never be able to compete. Right now, the global petrochemical industry is currently aiming to double its global capacity to make brand new plastic. It's not just about recycling, reusing, reducing, repairing, and redesigning like they do in Taiwan. It's about rethinking. About what we buy and what happens to it afterwards. I'm Laurie Chen. Thanks for listening to China's Recycling Revolution.
There's this stuff that's everywhere. Well, I can see it right here and over there. It comes from deep below the ground, but we spend a lot of time just spreading it round. I'm talking about plastic. It's not fantastic because it never ever goes away. Don't wanna use it. We've got to lose it, because otherwise it'll be here to stay.
been listening to China's Recycling Revolution, written and produced by Jared Walt, presented by Laurie Chan. Additional research, Hong Kong field recordings and production by Lisa Harding. Malaysia field recordings by Tashni Sukumaran. Shanghai field recordings by Yang Yang. Voiceovers by Joe Kynes and Yuki Sang. Another podcast in the Inside China series from the South China Morning Post. You can find more of our podcasts on Asian food, technology in China, and the US-China trade war at scmp.com/podcasts.